The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Anna Mateo, Katie Weaver, and John Russell. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Anna Mateo.
Outside the city of Denver, Colorado, a large industrial building sits between an auto repair business and a used computer business. In that building, a man deals daily with life and death. Seth Vidal and his employees have built a burial container, or vessel. Recently, they told reporters from the Associated Press that they hope this vessel will be the start of a more environmentally friendly type of burial science. This process will include the natural breakdown of the human body. Those in the burial business call this body composting. It is a natural process where the body is returned to an elemental level over a short period of time, said Vidal.
He said it is similar to composting of food and yard waste. This is the same process, but done with a human body inside of a vessel, and in our case, in a controlled environment. On September 7, 2021, Colorado became the second state after Washington to permit human body composting. Oregon will permit the practice beginning next July. In Washington state, there are three businesses licensed to compost human remains. Together, they have composted at least 85 bodies since the law took effect in May 2020. More than 900 people have signed up for this service as natural funerals become more popular.
Vidal co-owns The Natural Funeral in Lafayette, Colorado. Soon after the Colorado legislation was signed into law, he started building the vessel in an industrial part of town. The vessel is about 2 meters long, about 1 meter wide, and about 1 meter deep. The box is lined with waterproof material and packed with wood chips and straw. Two large wheels on either end allow it to be rolled across the floor. This provides the air and movement needed for a body to compost. The vessel must reach 55 degrees Celsius for 72 continuous hours to kill any bacteria and germs. Teeth are removed to prevent poisoning from chemicals used in teeth repair.
Then, after about 3 months, the vessel is opened and the soil is examined for medical devices. The remaining large bones are returned to the vessel for another 3 months of composting. In 6 months, the body, wood chips, and straw will turn into soil. Family members can keep the soil to use in their yards. However, Colorado law forbids selling it and using it to grow food for human use. Also, the state only permits licensed funeral homes and crematories to compost human bodies.
Vidal calls the process an exciting, environmentally friendly choice. He added that in death, he also sees life. Composting itself is a very living function, and it is performed by living organisms, he told reporters. He added that there are billions of microbes in our bodies, and when life ends, the life of those microbes continues. Vidal said body composting successfully turns the body back into something good for the earth. However, not everyone approves of body composting. The Colorado Catholic Conference is a group of religious leaders who aim to shape public policy. They oppose the process. The religious organization said in statements that body composting does not promote human dignity. Some Jewish religious leaders are also against body composting. They say it violates Jewish religious law. Other opponents are concerned about a lack of research. They fear the body compost might poison the soil. They also fear misuse of the body soil. We don't know what they're going to do with it if they take it all home, said Stacy Kleinman. She is a board member of the Colorado Funeral Directors Association. The group helped to write the legislation, but has said it is not for or against body composting.
Opposition aside, several other U.S. states are considering body composting. More Americans seem to be becoming open to green burial practices. This past summer, the Choice Mutual Insurance Agency asked 1,500 Americans how they wanted their bodies to be dealt with. Traditional burial and cremation were the common answer. However, 11% said they would choose a burial involving a natural process. Back in 2020, only 4% said they would choose that. Choice Mutual did not specifically ask about body composting, but the results seem to show an increased interest in more natural and environmentally friendly options.
The natural funeral charges $7,900 for body composting, compared with $2,200 for flame cremation. Vidal notes that a traditional burial and service in the Denver area can cost more than $10,000. The company has not yet composted any bodies, but several people have signed up and paid for the service. Micah Truman is head of the company Return Home near Seattle, Washington. So far, his company has composted 16 bodies. Truman said body composting is new, so he said it is a matter of changing hearts and minds right now. But he has been surprised by how many young people are interested. Our young people are going to teach us how to die better. It has been really powerful for us, Truman said. He added that younger generations have a greater connection to living and dying in ways that are friendlier to the earth. I'm Ana Mateo.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
Easy on Me, by British singer and songwriter Adele, has been at the top of Billboard's The Hot 100 and Global 200 lists this week. In today's Everyday Grammar, we will explore how the emotional song can teach you about English grammar. You will learn about subject and object pronouns, expressions, the imperative form, and more. Let's start by exploring the name of the song. The song's name is Easy on Me. The name probably comes from some of the words you hear in the song, Go Easy on Me, or Go Easy on Me, Baby.
So go easy on me. Go easy on me, baby.
The words use the imperative or command form of the verb go. As is often the case with this form, the subject pronoun, you, is missing. Although the subject is not stated, Adele does give a clue about the person she is singing to. She uses the term baby, a term that is used to speak to a loved one. Note that Adele also uses an object pronoun, me. This object pronoun comes at the end of the expression, go easy on. Go easy on means to not treat someone too harshly or in a way that is too demanding. In other words, when you ask someone to go easy on someone else, you are asking them to not demand too much or to not be too severe. Imagine you see a parent who is talking to their child in a harsh way. Someone might say,
"You should go easy on him."
Or,
"You should go easy on her."
The speaker could also reduce their statement by using the imperative form and say,
"Go easy on him."
Or,
"Go easy on her."
Note that in the examples, the object pronoun comes at the end, just after "go easy on." You could change the object pronoun after go easy on to make any number of statements. Go easy on us, go easy on them, for example. Let's listen to the beginning of the song.
There ain't no gold in this river that I've been washing my hands in forever.
Note that Adele uses the short form ain't. This is an informal way to negate a statement. It is common in everyday speech, but is generally not used in formal kinds of writing. If the words of the song were a bit more formal, they would sound something like this.
There is no gold in this river.
Or,
there is not any gold in this river.
But such wording would not be the right fit for the emotions Adele wants to express. This is a personal, emotional song. So more casual structures make sense. They make the feelings and words of the song more believable. In today's report, we explored what a popular song can teach you about grammar. The next time you are listening to music in English, pay careful attention to subject and object pronouns, the imperative form, and different expressions. Make note of the different terms and structures you hear. Then try to use what you have learned by making your own sentences. You do not need to explore much of a song in order to get a lot of information from it. I'm John Russell.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus.
If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. 2 years of a bitter, bloody civil war started to show their effects on both the Confederate States of the South and the Union States of the North. Both sides began to feel the pressure of the costly struggle. The South, however, felt the pressure more severely because it was weaker in troop strength and industrial strength. Morris Joyce and Jack Moyles discuss the early summer of 1863 in the American Civil War.
In 1863, the Confederate States were becoming short of supplies. Food and guns were difficult to find to keep the Confederate armies in the field. Men were also needed, more and more men. There seemed to be no end to the demand for men to fill the places left empty by dead and wounded soldiers. Many in the South were heavy of heart, and hope among them slowly started to sink. The war was tiring. Its suffering was more than they could bear. And the situation in the West made matters worse. Union armies were on the move in the states of Mississippi and Tennessee. Their successes were becoming a serious threat. They might soon win control of the whole Mississippi River. This would split the states of the Confederacy and might end its very existence. Something was needed to raise up the spirits of the South, to break the pressure of Union armies.
General Robert E. Lee believed that he had the answer, an invasion of the North. This, he felt, would throw fear into the people of the North and weaken the Union war effort. Lee had organized an army of 75,000 men at Fredericksburg, Virginia, halfway between Washington and Richmond. Lee began moving his men June 3rd. They marched northwest into the Shenandoah Valley. The valley led north to the Potomac River. Across the river was the narrow neck of western Maryland, then Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania was the target. Its rich farmland produced plenty of food, enough to feed Lee's hungry army for the summer. Standing in the way of Lee's army was a small Union force at Winchester in Northern Virginia. There were only 7,000 Union soldiers, and they had no idea that the Confederate army was nearby. The Confederates easily defeated them. More than half of the Union troops were captured. The others fled. Now, there was nothing to stop Lee from marching into Pennsylvania. The huge Army of the Potomac was behind him, near Washington. The Union commander, General Hooker, had to keep the army between Lee and Washington to prevent the Confederates from seizing the national capital.
Lee's army crossed western Maryland and entered Pennsylvania. His soldiers found the Pennsylvania countryside very different from Virginia's. Virginia had been a battleground for 2 years, and the land showed it. Many of its farms had been destroyed. Its stores were empty. Pennsylvania had not been touched by the war. Its big farms were rich. Its towns and villages were full of food and goods of all kinds. The hungry, poorly clothed soldiers could not believe their eyes. "This was the land of the enemy," they cried, "and they could take whatever they wished." But General Lee said no. He said supplies could be taken only by Confederate supply officers. And, he said, they must pay in Confederate money for everything they took.
Lee did not want to anger these people in Pennsylvania. Many of them did not support the Union war effort. Some of the rich farmers said openly that they did not care who won the war. They said they only wanted to be left alone. Lee was sure that many in the North felt the same way. There had been signs that people were growing tired of the war. Coal miners in eastern Pennsylvania had shown their feelings toward the war a few months earlier. They rose up against a new law drafting men into the Union Army. The miners did not want to fight. They refused to join the army. They rioted and attacked officials who tried to take them. Soldiers were sent to the mining areas to put down the riots.
Farmers in nearby Ohio also rebelled against the draft law. They refused to be drafted. Instead, they took guns and battled soldiers who came to arrest them. Feelings against the war were growing stronger, not only in Pennsylvania and Ohio, but also in several other farm states of the North. These areas saw a growing support for a peace party, a political party opposed to the war. Leaders of this movement were Democrats called Copperheads. They got this name because they wore on their coats a copper penny with the head of an Indian.
The chief Copperhead was a former Ohio congressman. His name was Clement Vallandigham. As a member of Congress, Vallandigham criticized the war and the Republicans. He told them, "The war for the Union is, in your hands, a most bloody and costly failure. War for the Union was abandoned, and war for the Negro was openly begun with stronger effort than before." "With what success?" Vallandigham asked. "Let the dead at Fredericksburg and Vicksburg answer." Vallandigham said he wanted peace, and he wanted it immediately. He offered a simple program: stop the fighting, make a ceasefire, and let some friendly foreign nation negotiate peace between North and South.
After he lost his seat in Congress, Vallandigham opened a campaign to become governor of Ohio. He traveled all across the state, speaking out against the war. He said Republicans did not want peace. He said they wanted to fight until every black man was free. The Union military commander for Ohio was General Ambrose Burnside, a former commander of the Army of the Potomac. After losing the Battle of Fredericksburg, Lincoln removed Burnside as Army commander and sent him to Ohio. Burnside was worried. Too many people in Ohio opposed the war. He believed that much of what was being said and done in Ohio was close to the crime of treason.
Burnside announced several new measures to quiet the opponents of the war. One of these orders limited the right of citizens to criticize government military policy. Another declared that statements of support for the enemy would be punished as treason. Vallandigham refused to recognize Burnside's right to give such orders to civilians. On May 1st, he made a campaign speech to a big crowd at Mount Vernon, Ohio. He denounced Burnside's orders and spoke of the president as King Lincoln. Vallandigham claimed that Lincoln was using the war to become a dictator. He said Lincoln did not want peace, that the president had rejected peace offers from the South. Once again, he said the war was not a struggle for the Union, but a fight to free the slaves of the South. And he said, "Men of Ohio, who let themselves be drafted into the Union Army, were no better than slaves themselves."
Burnside had sent several Army officers to listen to the speech. When they reported what Vallandigham said, Burnside ordered his arrest. Without question, the man had violated the general's orders. Late the next night, soldiers went to Vallandigham's home in Dayton. They knocked on the door and said they had come to arrest him. Vallandigham called for help and refused to let the soldiers enter. They broke down the door, seized him, and took him to a military prison in Cincinnati. A few days later, Vallandigham went on trial before a military court in Cincinnati. That will be our story in the next program of The Making of a Nation.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.